Random House Audiobooks presents P is for Peril by Sue Grafton. Read for you by Judy Kay.
P is for Peril. Chapter 1. The house on Old Reservoir Road appeared to be in the final phases of construction. I spotted the site as I rounded the curve, recognizing the unfinished structure from Fiona Purcell's description. To my right, I could see a portion of the reservoir for which the road was named. Brunswick Lake fills the bottom of a geological bowl, a spring-fed body that supplied the town with drinking water for many years. In 1953, a second, larger catch basin was established, and now Brunswick is little more than an irregular blue splotchlet on maps of the area. Swimming and boating are forbidden, but seasonally the migrating water birds rest on the placid surface as they make their way south. The surrounding hills are austere, gentle swells rising to the mountains that mark the northernmost boundary of the Santa Teresa city limits. I parked my VW on the gravel berm and crossed the two-lane road. The steeply pitched lot was still bare of landscaping and consisted entirely of raw dirt and boulders, with a dusting of weeds taking hold. At street level, a big commercial dumpster was piled high with debris. A small grove of signs planted in the yard announced the names of the building contractor, the painting contractor, and the architect, though Mrs. Purcell had been quick to assure me by phone that she'd drawn up the plans herself. The design, if that's what you want to call it, would have been approved by the Department of Defense, an implacable series of concrete boxes, staunch and unadorned, stacked up against the hillside under a pale November sun. The facade was as blank as a bunker, a radical contrast to the sprawling Spanish-style homes on adjacent properties. Somewhere to the rear of the house, there must have been a driveway leading to garages and a parking pad, but I opted for the stairs built into the barren hillside. At 6 a.m., I'd done a 3-mile jog, but I'd skipped my Friday morning weightlifting to keep this early appointment. It was just now 8 o'clock, and I could feel my butt dragging as I mounted the steps. Behind me, I could hear a dog bark. Its deep-throated yaps echoed through the canyon, conveying a message of excitement. A woman was calling, "Trudy! Trudy!" while the dog barked on. She emitted a piercing whistle, and a young German shepherd came bounding over the hill, heading in my direction at full speed. I waited, bracing myself for the force of muddy feet. But at the last possible second, the whistle came again, and the dog sprinted off. I continued climbing Fiona's wide concrete steps, tacking twice before I reached the upper terrace with its plain limestone portico that shaded the front entrance. By then, my thighs were burning. I was huffing and puffing, and my heart was rat-a-tat-tatting like machine gun fire. I could have sworn there was less oxygen in the air up here. But I'd actually only climbed the equivalent of 2 stories, and I knew it was probably no more than 300 to 400 feet above sea level. I turned, pretending to admire the view, while I recovered my breath. From this area, I could see the broad, shimmering band of the Pacific Ocean stitched to the shoreline some 5 miles away. Before me, the day was so clear I could almost count the mountain ridges on the islands 26 miles out. Behind me, the clouds were appearing over the mountaintops, a fast-moving blanket of dark gray in advance of a storm. San Francisco, 400 miles to the north of us, was already feeling its lash. By the time I rang the bell, my breathing had slowed, and I'd done a quick mental review of the subject I was here to discuss. Fiona Purcell's ex-husband, Dr. Dowan Purcell, had been missing for 9 weeks. She'd had a messenger deliver a manila envelope filled with newspaper clippings that recapped events surrounding his disappearance. I'd sat in my office, tilted back in my swivel chair, my Sauconys propped on the edge of my desk, while I studied the articles she'd sent. She'd arranged them chronologically, but had otherwise presented them without editorial comment. I'd been following the story in the local papers, but I'd never anticipated my involvement in the case. I found it helpful to have the sequence laid out again in this truncated form. I noticed that over the course of 9 weeks, the character of the coverage had shifted from the first 72 hours of puzzlement, through days of feverish speculation, and into the holding pattern that represented the current state of the investigation. Nothing new had come to light, not that there was ever much to report. In the absence of fresh revelations, the public's fascination had begun to dwindle, and the media's attention to the matter had become as chilly and abbreviated as the brief November days. It is a truth of human nature that we can ponder life's mysteries for only so long before we lose interest and move on to something else. Dr. Purcell had been gone since Friday, September 12, and the lengthy column inches initially devoted to his disappearance were now reduced to an occasional mention, nearly ritual in its tone. The details were recounted, but the curiosity had shifted to more compelling events. Dr. Purcell, 69 years old, had practiced family medicine in Santa Teresa since 1944, specializing in geriatrics for the last 15 years. He'd retired in 1981. 6 months later, he'd been licensed as the administrator of a nursing care facility called Pacific Meadows, which was owned by two businessmen. On the Friday night in question, he'd worked late, remaining in his office to review paperwork related to the operation of the nursing home. According to witnesses, it was close to 9 o'clock when he stopped at the front desk and said goodnight to the nurses on duty. At that hour, the occupants had settled down for the night. The corridors were empty and the residence doors were closed against the already dimmed hall lights. Dr. Purcell had paused to chat with an elderly woman sitting in the lobby in her wheelchair. After a cursory conversation, less than a minute by her report, the doctor passed through the front door and into the night. He retrieved his car from his reserved space at the north side of the complex, pulled out of the lot, and drove off into the inky void from which he'd never emerged. The Santa Teresa Police and the Santa Teresa County Sheriff's Departments had devoted endless hours to the case, and I couldn't think what avenues remained that hadn't already been explored by local law enforcement. I rang the bell again. Fiona Purcell had told me she was on her way out of town, a 5-day trip to San Francisco, to purchase furniture and antiques for a client of her interior design firm. According to the papers, Fiona and the doctor had been divorced for years. Idly, I was wondering why she'd been the one who called me instead of his current wife, Crystal. I saw a face appear in one of the two glass panels that flanked the entrance. When she opened the door, I saw that she was already dressed for travel in a double-breasted pinstripe suit with wide lapels. She held a hand out. "Ms. Milhone? Fiona Purcell. Sorry to make you wait. I was at the back of the house. Please come in." "Thanks. You can call me Kinsey if you like." "Nice meeting you," I said. We shook hands and I moved into the entrance hall. Her handshake was limp, always startling in someone who otherwise seems brisk and businesslike. I placed her in her late 60s, close to Dr. Purcell's age. Her hair was dyed a dark brown, parted on one side with puffy bangs and clusters of artificially constructed curls, pulled away from her face and secured by rhinestone combs, a style affected by glamour girl movie stars of the 1940s. I half expected an appearance by John Agar or Fred McMurray, some poor feckless male who'd fallen prey to this vixen with her fierce shoulder pads. She was saying, "We can talk in the living room. You'll have to pardon the mess." Scaffolding had been erected in the foyer, reaching to the lofty ceiling. Drop cloths lined the stairs and the wide corridor leading to the rear of the house. To one side of the stairs, there was a console table and a streamlined chrome lamp. Currently, we seem to be the only two on the premises. "Your flight's at 10, I asked. "Oh, don't worry about it. I'm 8 minutes from the airport. We have at least an hour. May I offer you coffee? I'm having mine in here." "No, thanks. I've had 2 cups this morning, and that's my limit most days." Fiona moved to the right, and I followed in her wake, crossing a broad expanse of bare cement. I said, "When do the floors go in?" "These are the floors," I said. "Ah," and made a mental note to quit asking about matters far beyond my ken. The interior of the house had the cool, faintly damp smell of plaster and fresh paint. All the walls and range were a dazzling white, the windows tall and stark, unadorned by any curtains or drapes. A sly glance behind me revealed what was probably the dining room on the far side of the entryway, empty of furniture, subdivided by rhomboids of clear morning light. The echo of our footsteps sounded like a small parade. In the living room, Fiona gestured toward one of two matching armchairs, chunky and oversized, upholstered in a neutral-toned fabric that blended with the gray cement floor. A large area rug showed a densely woven grid of black lines on gray. I sat when she did, watching as she surveyed the space with the practiced eye of an aesthete. The furnishings were striking: light wood, tubular steel, stark geometric shapes. An enormous round mirror resting in a crescent of chrome hung above the fireplace. A tall silver and ivory coffee pot with a matching creamer and sugar bowl sat on a silver tray on the beveled glass coffee table. She paused to refill her cup. "Are you a fan of Art Deco?" "I don't know much about it." "I've been collecting for years. The rugs are de Silva Bruns. This is Wolfgang Tumpel's work, if you're familiar with the name," she said, nodding at the coffee service. "Beautiful," I murmured, clueless. "Most of these pieces are one of a kind, created by craftsmen who were masters in their day. I'd go on rattling the names off, but I doubt they'd mean much if you're not acquainted with the period. I built this as a showcase for my collection, but as soon as the house is finished, I'll probably sell it and move on. I'm impatient by nature and far too restless to stay here long." She had strong features, thinly arched brows and dark smudged eyes, with pronounced streaks of weariness descending from the inner corners. She took a sip of coffee and then paused to extract a cigarette from a pack sitting on the table. The lighter she used was one of those small gold items and made very little sound when she flipped the cover back and thumbed the striker wheel. She held the lighter in her palm and drew deeply on her cigarette, clearly savoring the relief. She tilted her head toward the ceiling and blew the smoke out in a stream. I figured I could always drop my blazer at the cleaners on the way home. She said, "I don't think I mentioned this when we chatted the other day, but Dana Glaser suggested I get in touch with you. I believe she was Dana Jaffe when you were acquainted with her."
"Really? How do you know her?"
"I'm helping her redecorate her home. She's now married to one of Dow's associates, Joel Glaser, whose first wife died. Do you know Joel? He's a partner in a company called Century Comprehensive that owns a chain of nursing homes, among other things."
"I know the name Glaser from the papers. I've never met him," I said. Her call was beginning to make sense, though I still wasn't sure how I could be of service. Dana Jaffe's first husband, Wendell, had disappeared in 1979, though the circumstances, on the surface, were very different from the current case. Wendell Jaffe was a self-made real estate tycoon who'd faked his own death, showing up in Mexico shortly after his widow had collected $500,000 in life insurance benefits. Wendell was facing jail time after a Ponzi scheme he'd cooked up threatened to unravel, exposing his chicanery. The pseudo-side was his attempt to avoid the inevitable felony conviction. He might have pulled it off, but he'd been spotted in Mexico by a former acquaintance, and I'd been dispatched by the insurance company who wanted their money back. I wondered if Fiona suspected her ex-husband had pulled a fast one as well. She set her coffee cup aside. "You received the articles?" "A messenger dropped them off at the office yesterday. I read them last night and then again this morning. The police have been thorough, or so they like us to think." "You're not happy with their progress?"
"Progress? What progress? Dowan is still missing. I'll tell you what they've accomplished. Zilch. I grant you they're going through the motions, making public pronouncements, trumpeting their concerns. But it's all sound and fury, signifying nothing." I objected to her attitude, but decided not to protest just yet. "I think the cops are terrific, but why argue the point? She wanted to hire me, and I was here to determine what, if anything, I could contribute." "What's the latest?" I asked. "No one's heard a peep from him, at least as far as I've been told." She took another drag on her cigarette and then tapped the ash into a heavy crystal ashtray. Her lipstick was dark and bled into the fine hairline crevices along her upper lip. She'd left a distinct half-moon on the coffee cup and a full ring around the filter of her cigarette. Her jewelry was clunky, big clip-on silver earrings and a matching bracelet. The effect was stylish, but everything about her suggested estate sales and vintage clothing shops. I fancied if I'd bent close, I'd have picked up the whiff of mothballs and cedar closets mingled with the scents from the 40s, Shalimar, and old golds. In moments, her looks were striking, harsh flickers of beauty she seemed at pains to accentuate. She lowered her eyes.
Of course, you realize we're divorced. There was reference to that in one of the articles you sent. What about his current wife? I've only spoken to Crystal once throughout this whole ordeal. She's gone to great lengths to keep me out of the loop. I receive updates through my daughters, who've made it a point to stay in close touch with her. Without them, I'd have even less information than I do, which God knows isn't much. You have two girls? Correct. My youngest, Blanche, and her husband are only 4 blocks away. Melanie, the older one, lives in San Francisco. I'll be staying with her till Tuesday afternoon of next week.
Any grandchildren?
Mel's never been married. Blanche is expecting her 5th in about 3 weeks. I said, wow. Fiona's smile was sour. Motherhood's just her way of avoiding a real job.
A real job sounds easier. I couldn't do what she does.
She barely manages herself. Fortunately, the children have a nanny who's extremely competent. How do your daughters get along with Crystal? Fine, I suppose. Then again, what choice do they have? If they don't dance to her tune, she'll make sure they never see their father or their half-brother again. You know, Dow and Crystal have a son. His name is Griffith. He just turned 2.
I remember mention of the boy. May I call you Fiona?
She took another drag of her cigarette and placed it on the lip of the ashtray in front of her. I'd prefer Mrs. Purcell, if it's all the same to you. Smoke trailed from her mouth as she spoke, and she seemed to study it, bemused.
Yes, well, I'm wondering if you have a theory about your ex-husband's disappearance.
You're one of the few who's even bothered to ask. Apparently my opinion is of no concern. I suspect he's in Europe or South America, biding his time until he's ready to come home. Crystal thinks he's dead, or so I've heard. It's not so far-fetched. According to the papers, there's been no activity on his credit cards. There's been no sign of his car and no sign of him.
Well, that's not quite true. There have been a number of reports. People claim to have spotted him as far away as New Orleans and Seattle. He was seen getting on a plane at JFK and again south of San Diego, heading for Mexico.
There are still sightings of Elvis. That doesn't mean he's alive and well.
True. On the other hand, someone fitting Dow's description tried to cross into Canada, but walked away when the immigration officer asked to see his passport, which is missing, by the way.
Really? That's interesting. The papers didn't mention it. I take it the police have followed up.
One can only hope, she remarked. There was something hollow in her tone. If she could only persuade me, then perhaps what she said would turn out to be true.
You're convinced he's alive?
I can't imagine otherwise. The man has no enemies, and I can't conceive his being the victim of foul play, she said, forming the quote marks with her fingers. The idea is absurd.
Because? Dow's perfectly capable of taking care of himself, physically at any rate. What he's not capable of doing is facing the problems in life. He's passive. Instead of fight or flight, he lies down and plays dead, in a manner of speaking. He'd rather do anything than deal with conflict, especially involving women. This goes back to his mother, but that's another story altogether.
Has he done anything like this before?
As a matter of fact, he has. I tried to explain this to the police detective, in vain, I might add. Dowan's done this twice. The first time, Melanie and Blanche were, what, probably 6 and 3. Dowan disappeared for 3 weeks. He left without warning and returned much the same way.
Where'd he go?
I have no idea. The second time was similar. This was years later, before we separated for good. One day he was here, the next he was gone. He came back a few weeks later without a murmur of explanation or apology. Naturally, I've assumed this recent disappearance was a repeat performance.
What prompted his departure on those earlier occasions?
Her gesture was vague, smoke trailing from the tip of her cigarette.
I suppose we were having problems. We usually were. At any rate, Dow kept saying he needed time to clear his head, whatever that means. One day soon after that, he simply didn't come home. He'd cancel his appointments, including social engagements, all without a word to me or to anyone else. The first I became aware was when he failed to arrive for dinner. The second time was the same, except I didn't go out of my mind with worry.
So, in both of those instances, he behaved much as he did this time?
Exactly. The first time, it took hours before I realized he was gone. The man's a doctor, and naturally he was often delayed. By midnight, I was wild, close to hysterical. I thought I'd go mad.
You called the police?
I called everyone I could think of. Then, first thing the next morning, a note arrived in the mail. He said he'd come home eventually, which is exactly what he did. I was furious, of course, but he seemed totally unconcerned. Fool that I am, I forgave him, and we went on as before. The marriage was good, or good enough, from my perspective. I thought he was happy until this business with Crystal. For all I know, he'd been fooling around with her for years.
What made you stay?
I thought he was a good husband. That's how innocent I was. He tended to be distant, but I didn't fault him, at least on a conscious level. I might have harbored resentments, but I wasn't aware of them. Looking back, I realize there are many ways a man can disappear. Such as, she shrugged, stubbing out her cigarette, television, sleep, alcohol, books, uppers, downers. I'm speaking in general terms, but you get my drift.
And in his case?
Dow buried himself in his work. Went in early, stayed at the office until all hours of the night. What you have to understand about him is he's someone who avoids disagreements. That's why he loves the elderly, because they make no real demands on him. Being a physician gives him status, which has always been better in his mind than having to be accountable like any ordinary mortal.
How long were you married?
Close to 40 years. We met at Syracuse. I was majoring in art history, and he was pre-med. We married shortly after graduation. Dow went on to medical school at Penn State and did his internship and residency out here. By then, we had the girls. I stayed home with them until they were both in school, and then I went back and got my master's in interior design. I designed the house we built soon afterward in Horton Ravine. Of course, we hired an architect to handle all the nuts and bolts.
He still owns that house?
Yes, though Crystal doesn't care for it, from what I've heard.
You didn't ask for the house and the settlement?
I couldn't afford the mortgage and upkeep. To hear him tell it, he was fleeced. Strictly his point of view. Believe me, he got the better deal. He probably paid someone off. The judge, my lawyer. You know how men stick together when it comes to the almighty buck. I noticed she was busy shading my perception, scoring points for her team. Divorced folk always seem to angle for your sympathy, casting themselves in the best possible light. It seemed odd in this case, when the reason for my visit was to see if I could be of help in the search for him. Was she still in love with the man?
It must have been difficult when the marriage broke up, I murmured.
Humiliating. Devastating. It was such a cliché. Doctor goes through a midlife crisis, leaves his middle-aged wife to take up with some whore.
The papers had had a field day with the fact that Crystal had been a stripper. Still, I questioned Fiona's use of the word whore. Stripping as a way of earning money doesn't necessarily translate into hookerdom. For all we knew, Crystal might have earned her master's in psychiatric social work.
How did he meet her?
You'd have to ask her that.
The truth is, Dow developed an appetite for, unusual sexual practices. His hormones were off, or his anxiety levels began to climb as he aged. Possibly his problems hark back to his mother. Everything else connects to his relationship with her. Whatever the reason, once Dowen turned 60, he began to falter. He couldn't, let's say, perform without stimulus, pornography, marital aids, which didn't appeal to you. I thought it was revolting. I can't even tell you the practices he wanted to pursue, unspeakable acts that I refused even to discuss with him. He finally stopped pressing.
Because he'd taken up with her?
Evidently. He's never admitted it, but I'm sure he went looking. It did cross my mind he'd go out and find someone willing to submit to his perverse requests. I certainly wouldn't do it, and I knew I had made myself entirely clear on that point.
I was secretly panting for an example, but I thought it was wiser, for once, to keep my big mouth shut. Sometimes you don't want to know what people do or refuse to do in private. If I had occasion to meet the doctor one day, I didn't want to be distracted by an image of him cavorting in the nude with an organic carrot up his butt. Did you ask for the divorce, or did he?
He did. I was completely taken off guard. I presumed he'd get his needs met outside the marriage and keep his family intact. I never thought he'd stoop to divorce at this late stage in his life. I should have known. Dowan's weak. Not that any of us relish owning up to our mistakes, but Dow always abhorred even the appearance of failure.
Meaning what? Well, she said, lowering her eyes. I watched her gaze dance across the floor. I suspect his relationship with Crystal is not the union of souls he'd like others to believe. Some months ago, he'd heard she was screwing around on him. Better to disappear than admit he'd been cuckolded.
Did he have any idea who it was?
No, but he was looking into it. After he disappeared, my friend Dana finally confided that she'd known the whole time. The fellow is Crystal's personal trainer. His name is Clint Augustine. I heard a little ding-dong going off in my head. I was sure I had heard the name before, possibly in the gym where I work out.
You believe he left because of that?
Yes. We had a conversation, a long talk, on September 10th. This was 2 days before he vanished. He was dreadfully unhappy.
He said that?
Her hesitation was distinct as she debated with herself.
Not in so many words, but you don't go through 40 years of marriage without learning to read between the lines.
What occasioned the conversation?
He came over to the house.
You were seeing him, I stated.
Well, yes, at his request, she said, her tone faintly defensive. Dow adores this place, just as he adores the house in Horton Ravine. He was always interested in my design work, even before our relationship underwent the shift. Lately, he'd been stopping by in the evenings to have a drink with me. That night, he was exhausted. His face was gray with worry, and when I asked what was wrong, he said the pressures of the office were driving him insane, and Crystal was no help. She's extremely narcissistic, as you'll discover when you meet her, which I assume you will.
Were you surprised he'd confide in you after everything he put you through?
Who else does he have? Anyway, he didn't really talk about her, but I could see the tension in his eyes. He'd aged a good 10 years in a matter of months.
You're saying he had problems at home as well as problems at work?
That's right. He didn't talk specifics, but he mentioned in passing that he needed to get away. That's the first thing I thought of when I heard he was gone.
Couldn't that have been wishful thinking?
I suppose it could, she said. I mean, he didn't pull out airline tickets, but he did seem desperate.
Do you remember a reference to any place in particular?
She tilted her head. I've racked my brain, but I really can't remember. It was an offhand remark, and I didn't think much about it until this came up.
I assume you told the police.
Again, she hesitated.
Not at first. I thought his absence was voluntary, and he'd come home when he was ready. I didn't want him to be embarrassed. Leave it to Crystal to turn this ordeal into a media circus.
I could feel myself bristle.
Mrs. Purcell, he's a prominent physician, well known and loved in this community. His disappearance is bound to attract media attention. If you thought he'd gone AWOL, why didn't you speak up?
I felt he was entitled to his privacy, she said, her cheeks coloring slightly.
What about all the time and money being spent on the investigation? Weren't you at all concerned about that?
Of course. That's why I spoke to the police, she said. After 6 weeks, I began to worry. I guess I was expecting a call or a note, some indication he was all right, wherever he was. Now that 9 weeks have passed, I thought it was time to take matters into my own hands.
What made you think he'd be in touch with you instead of her?
Because Crystal's the one he's been trying to escape.
And now you're worried something's happened to him.
I suppose so. That's why I decided to meet with the detective last week.
Odessa was polite. He took notes. But I got the impression he didn't take me seriously. He said he'd get back to me, but that's the last I've heard. The police must be working dozens of other cases, which means they don't have the time or resources to devote to Dow. I said as much to Dana, and she agrees. That's why she recommended you. I don't know what to say. Even if we come to some agreement, I can't spend 24 hours a day on this any more than the police can. I have other clients, too. I didn't say you'd have to be exclusive. Even so, I'm just one person. You'd be better off with a big Los Angeles agency, one with lots of operatives who can fan out across the country and do this properly. You might end up having to search for him overseas. She cut me off with a wave of her hand. I don't want a big LA agency. I want someone local who's willing to report directly to me. But all I'd be doing is repeating what the police have already done. You might have ideas they haven't thought of yet. After all, you tracked down Wendell Jaffe years after everyone assumed he was dead. I did track him down, but I didn't start from scratch. Someone spotted him in Mexico, and that's why the case finally broke. Her expression became withdrawn. You won't help. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about reality, which doesn't look that good. But what if there's an angle the police have overlooked? What if there's not? Then at least I'd be satisfied with the job they've done. I was silent for a beat, staring at the floor. Inside, a little voice was yelling, "No, no, no," while my mouth said, "I'll do what I can, but I make no promises." "Good! Oh, that's wonderful. We'll talk on Tuesday. Just keep track of the time you put in, and you can give me an invoice as soon as I get back." She glanced at her watch and then rose to her feet. I stood when she did. "I'll need a retainer." "A retainer?" She made a show of startlement, but I wondered if she was repeating the words for effect. Surely she didn't do business without a written agreement and earnest money changing hands. "How much did you have in mind?" "I charge $50 an hour or a flat $400 a day, plus expenses, so $1,500 should cover it for now. If you give me Melanie's address, I'll overnight you a contract for your signature." In truth, I could have brought one with me, but I hadn't been sure we'd end up coming to an agreement. She blinked as though baffled. "I'm sorry. I didn't picture anything so formal. Is this standard procedure in your line of work?" "Actually, it is," I said. I noticed she didn't call it a profession, which meant she probably lumped me in with retail clerks, short-order cooks, and roto-rooter men. "What if you fail to find him?" "That's exactly the point. If I come up empty-handed, you might decide I wasn't worth the hourly wage. Once I take a case, I persevere. I follow the trail right out to the bitter end." "I should hope so," she said. She thought about it briefly and then crossed to an ebony inlaid console. She removed her checkbook, returned to her chair, and sat down. "And I'm to make the check out to Milhone Investigations." I watched while she dashed off a check and tore it out of the book, scarcely bothering to disguise her irritation as she handed it to me. I noticed we were bankmates, sharing the same branch of the Santa Teresa City Bank. I said, "You're upset." "I operate on trust. Apparently, you don't. I've learned the hard way. It's nothing personal."
"I see."
I held out the check. "I can return this right now, if you'd prefer." "Just find him. I'll expect a full report the minute I get home." Chapter 2 Before I left Fiona's, she gave me Melanie's home address in San Francisco, along with her home and office numbers. I couldn't imagine the need to call Fiona up there. She also gave me Crystal's Horton Ravine address and phone number. I'd never met Detective Odessa, whom Fiona had mentioned in passing, but a conversation with him was the first item on my list. Driving back into town, I noticed my stomach had begun to churn with anxiety. I tried to pinpoint my doubts, laying them out one by one, though not necessarily in the order of importance. Number 1. I didn't particularly like or trust Fiona. She hadn't been candid with the cops, and I didn't think she was being entirely candid with me. Under the circumstances, I probably should have declined to take the job. Already I was regretting the haste with which I'd agreed. Number two, I wasn't sure I could be effective. I'm often uneasy at the outset of an investigation, especially one like this. 9 weeks had passed since Dr. Purcell was last seen. Whatever the circumstances surrounding a disappearance, the passage of time seldom works in your favor. Witnesses embellish, they invent. The memory grows foggy. The truth tends to blur with repetition, and details are altered to suit various personal interpretations. People want to be helpful, which means they embroider their stories, coloring events according to their biases as the situation drags on. Entering the game this late, I knew the likelihood of my making any critical discovery was almost out of the question. Fiona did have a point in that sometimes a fresh perspective can shift the focus of an investigation. All well and good, but intuition was telling me that any break in the case was going to be the result of serendipity, a term synonymous with unadulterated dumb luck. And number three, I didn't like the bullshit about the retainer. I stopped off at McDonald's and ordered coffee and a couple of Egg McMuffins. I needed the comfort of junk food as well as the nourishment, if that's what you want to call it. I munched while I drove, eating with such eagerness I bit my own index finger. I might as well take a moment here to identify myself. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a licensed private investigator in Santa Teresa, California, which is 95 miles north of Los Angeles. I'm female, 36, twice divorced, childless, and otherwise unencumbered. Aside from my car, I don't own much in the way of material possessions. My business, Milhone Investigations, consists entirely of me. I was a cop for 2 years early in my 20s, and through personal machinations too tedious to explain, I realized law enforcement didn't suit me. I was way too crabby and uncooperative to adjust to department regulations with all the ethics clauses thrown in. I have been known to bend the rules. Plus, the shoes were clunky, and the uniform and the belt made my ass look too wide. Having left gainful city employment, I apprenticed myself to a two-man office of private investigators, where I put in the hours necessary to apply for my license. I've been on my own for a good 10 years, licensed, bonded, and heavily insured. A good portion of the last decade I spent pursuing arson and wrongful death claims for California Fidelity Insurance, first as a bona fide employee, later as an independent contractor. We came to a parting of the ways 3 years ago in October 1983. Since then, I've rented space from the law firm of Kingman and Ives, an arrangement that I've begun to suspect was on the verge of change. For the past year, Lonnie Kingman had been complaining about the shortage of space. He'd already expanded once, taking over the entire third floor of a building he owns free and clear. He'd now purchased a second building, this one on Lower State Street, where he intended to relocate as soon as escrow closed. He'd found a tenant for our current digs, and the only question that remained was whether I'd go with him or find an office of my own. I'm a loner at heart, and while I'm fond of Lonnie, the whole idea of working in close contact with other people had begun to get on my nerves. I found myself going into the office nights and weekends, spending half my days working from home, anything to create the sense of space and solitude. I'd talked to a real estate broker about month-to-month rentals, and I'd responded to several classified ads. So far, I hadn't seen anything that really struck my fancy. My requirements were modest: room for my desk, swivel chair, file cabinets, and a few fake plants. In addition, I'd pictured a small but tasteful executive potty. The problem was that everything I liked was too large or too expensive, and anything that fit my budget was too cramped, too shabby, or too far from downtown. I spent a lot of time at the Hall of Records, and I liked to be within walking distance of the courthouse, the police station, and the public library. Lonnie's office was a haven. He doubles as my attorney if the shit hits the fan, which it very often does. The choice was tough, and I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do. As soon as I reached the 200 block of East Capillo, where Lonnie's office was located, I began the usual search-and-seizure mission, hunting for a parking place. One drawback to the current building was the tiny lot attached, which held only 12 cars.
Lonnie and his partner were each assigned a slot, as were their two secretaries, Ida Ruth Kenner and Jill Stahl. The remaining 8 spots went to the building's other tenants, so the rest of us were forced to ferret out parking where we could. Today I nosed my way into a short length of curb between 2 commercial driveways, a spot I could have sworn was almost legal. It was only later I discovered I'd been wrong. I walked the 5 blocks to the office, climbed the requisite 2 flights of stairs, and let myself into the suite through an unmarked side door. I crossed the interior hallway to my office, unlocked the door, and stepped in, carefully avoiding Ida Ruth and Jill, who were deep in conversation a short distance away. I knew the subject matter would be the same one they'd been debating for the past 2 months. Lonnie's partner, John Ives, had urged the firm to hire his niece as the receptionist when the position became open. Jennifer was 18 years old and a recent high school graduate. This was her first job, and despite having been given a lengthy written job description, she seemed thoroughly perplexed about what was expected of her. She showed up for work in t-shirts and miniskirts, her long blonde hair hanging down to her waist, legs bare, feet shoved into wood-soled clogs. Her phone voice was chirpy, her spelling was atrocious, and she couldn't seem to get the hang of coming in on time. She also took frequent 2-to-4-day vacations whenever her unemployed friends headed off to play. Ida Ruth and Jill were constantly exasperated at having to pick up the slack. Both bellyached to me, apparently reluctant to complain to Lonnie or John. Petty office politics have never held much appeal, which was yet another reason I was leaning toward a change in venue. Where I'd once been attracted to the sense of family I felt at the firm, now all I saw were attendant psychodramas. Jennifer was Cinderella with a diminutive IQ. Ida Ruth and Jill, like the spiteful stepsisters, were simperingly nice to her in person, but talked about her behind her back every chance they could. I'm not sure what part I played, but I did my best to avoid participation by hiding in my room. Clearly, I was no more adept at resolving conflicts than anyone else. In the interests of escape, I put a call through to the Santa Teresa Police Department and asked to speak to Detective Odessa. He was in a meeting, but the woman who took my call said he'd be free in a bit. I made an appointment for 10:30. I filled in a boilerplate contract and slipped it in an express mail envelope that I addressed to Fiona in care of Melanie's home in San Francisco. I tucked the whole of it in my handbag and then sat at my desk making deeply symbolic doodles on my blotter between rounds of solitaire. It's not as though I didn't have a ton of other work to do, but I found myself distracted by the information circulating through my brain. I finally pulled out a manila folder and a yellow legal pad and started taking notes. At 10:20, I locked my door and walked over to the post office, then continued to the police station, which was 4 blocks away. The morning air was chilly, and the earlier pale sunlight had faded as the sky clouded over with the first hint of rain. The Santa Teresa rainy season is unpredictable. Intermittent periods of precipitation once began in mid-January and extended willy-nilly into early March. Of late, weather extremes in other parts of the world have resulted in capricious deviations. From late May until October, rain levels can still be measured in fractions of an inch. But the winter months now vary, and this one was shaping up to be one of the wettest in years. A cold front was moving down from Alaska, pushing a raw wind ahead of it. The tree branches moved restlessly, bending and creaking, while dried palm fronds broke loose and swept along the sidewalks like brooms. The lobby at the police station seemed cozy by comparison. On my left, a small boy sat waiting on the wooden bench while his father talked to the civilian clerk about copies of an accident report. I moved to the L-shaped counter where a uniformed officer monitored the walk-in trade. I told him of my appointment, and he relayed the information to Detective Odessa's desk by phone. "He'll be right out." I waited where I was, glancing idly into records across the counter to my right. My friend Emerald had taken early retirement, leaving me with no buddy to slip me information. She'd never actually violated department policy, but she'd come close a few times. Detective Odessa opened the door and stuck his head around the frame. "Ms. Milhone?" "That's me." "Vince Odessa," he said, and we shook hands. "Come on back." I said, "Thanks."
He handed me a visitor's badge that I clipped to my lapel. He wore a blue dress shirt, a dark tie, chinos, dark socks, and shiny black shoes. His hair was dark and the back of his head was flat, as though he'd slept on his back for his entire infancy. He was taller than I, probably 5'9" to my 5'6". He held the door, allowing me to pass into the corridor in front of him. I paused and he took the lead. He walked ahead of me and turned left, passing through a door marked Investigations. I followed him through a warren of small offices. Over his shoulder, he said, "Shelley mentioned this was in regard to Dr. Purcell." "That's right. His ex-wife hired me to look into his disappearance." Odessa kept his tone neutral. "I had a feeling that was coming. She was in here last week."
"What'd you make of her?"
"I'll have to take the fifth. You on the clock?"
"I haven't deposited her check. I thought it'd be smart to talk to you first."
His office was tucked into a standard cubicle, shoulder-high gray walls carpeted in a tight synthetic loop. He took a seat at his desk, offering me the only other chair in the compact space. Framed photos of his family were arranged in front of him, wife, three daughters, and a son. A small metal bookcase behind him was neatly lined with department manuals, texts, and assorted law books. He was clean-shaven except for a line of whiskers he'd missed when his razor jumped over the cleft in his chin. His dark brows were fierce over dark blue eyes.
"So, what can I help you with?"
"I'm not sure. I'd love to hear what you have, if you're willing to share."
"I got no problem with that," he said.
He leaned forward, checking through a stack of thick files on one side of his desk. He pulled a three-ring binder from the bottom of the pile and set it in front of him.
"Place is a mess. They tell us we're switching over to computers in the next 6-8 months. Paperless office. You believe that stuff?"
"It'd be nice, but I doubt it."
"So do I," he said.
He leafed through numerous pages to the initial incident report.
"I just got this promotion. I'm junior man on the team, so this is a training exercise as far as they're concerned. Let's see what we got."
His gaze zigzagged along the page.
"Crystal Purcell filed a missing persons Tuesday morning, September 16, 72 hours after the doctor failed to arrive home as scheduled. Records took the information. We'd had some residential burglaries that same weekend, so I didn't pick up the report until noon Thursday, September 18. As far as we could determine, Purcell wasn't at risk, and there was nothing suspicious about the circumstances of his disappearance."
He paused to look at me.
"Tell you the truth, we figured he'd gone off on his own. You know how it is. Half the time the guy shows up later with his tail between his legs. Turns out he's got a girlfriend or he's been off on a bender with the boys somewhere. Might be half a dozen explanations, all of them harmless. It's aggravating to the wife, but nothing sinister."
He leaned back in his chair.
"500,000 to 1,000,000 people run away each year. It's tough on family and friends. You've probably seen it yourself. At first, they get into denial. Can't believe someone would do such a rotten thing to them. Later, they get mad. Anyway, I called the current Mrs. Purcell and made an appointment for Friday afternoon. This was September 19. Frankly, I stalled, assuming she'd hear from him. Which she didn't. Not then and not since. From what she says, he wasn't suffering any physical condition that raised a flag on that score. No heart problems, diabetes, no history of mental illness. She said she'd called and talked to him at the office. This was September 12, shortly after lunch. Purcell told her he'd be late, but there was no mention of his not coming home at all. By Saturday morning, she was frantic, calling everyone she knew. Friends, relatives, his colleagues, hospitals, CHP, the morgue, you name it. There was no sign of him. I sat with her for an hour. This was at the house in Horton Ravine. She's got another place at the beach he stays most weekends. I went through the drill, asked about habits, hobbies, job, country club memberships. Had a look at his bedroom, went through his chest of drawers, phone bills, credit card receipts. I checked his credit card accounts for any recent activity, address book, calendar, covering all those bases.
Nothing surfaced? He held up a finger.
I'll get to that in a minute. Over the next couple weeks, we went through the mail at his home and at the clinic, arranged a mail cover, talked to his associates, entered him in the DOJ missing persons system, and put a stop on his license plate. Meantime, you have to understand, we're not talking about a crime here, so this is strictly a public service. We're doing what we can, but there's no evidence to suggest we got a problem on our hands.
Fiona tells me his passport's missing. Odessa smiled ruefully.
So's mine, for that matter. Just because his wife can't lay hands on it doesn't mean it's gone. We did come across a recent statement for a savings account at Mid-City Bank. And this is what caught our attention. It looks like he made a series of cash withdrawals, $30,000 worth, over the past 2 years. Balance drops from 13 grand to 3 in the past 10 months alone. The last activity on the account was August 29. His wife doesn't seem to know anything about it.
You think he was prepping for departure?
Well, it sure looks that way. Granted, 30,000 won't get you far in this day and age, but it's a start. He might have milked other accounts we haven't come up with yet. It's always possible the guy's a gambler, and this is his stake. She says he's not, but she might have been kept in the dark.
Could we go back to the passport? If Purcell left the country, wouldn't Customs have a record of it?
You'd think so. Assuming his was the passport he used, he might have traded in his personal ID, driver's license, birth certificate, and passport for a set of phony papers, which means he could have flown to Europe or South America under someone else's name. Or he might have driven into Canada, booked a flight, and left from there.
Or he might be lying low, I said.
Right?
Wouldn't someone have spotted his car?
No guarantee of that. He could have run it off a cliff or driven into Mexico and sold it to a chop shop. Park a car like that in South Central and see how fast it disappears.
What kind of car?
Four-door Mercedes sedan. Silver, vanity plate reads, Dr. P.
I said, you haven't mentioned foul play.
No reason to, or if there is, I don't see it. It's not like we found bloodstains in the parking lot outside the nursing home. No signs of a struggle, no evidence of assault, and no reason to believe he was forcibly removed. We canvassed the neighborhood, hitting every house within range. Nobody saw or heard a thing that night.
Fiona thinks he might have left on his own. What's your take on it?
Personally, I don't like the feel of it.
9 weeks with zip. You almost have to assume there's something else going on.
We're beginning to backtrack, looking for anything we might have missed the first go-round.
Did Fiona's story affect the investigation?
In what regard?
All this talk of his past disappearances, I said. Odessa waved that aside.
Air and sunshine. She says he's gone off before. Maybe so, maybe not. I'm not entirely clear about her motive.
According to her, she wants results.
Sure, but who doesn't? We're cops, not magicians. We don't perform miracles.
Did you believe the story she told?
I believe he left her. Whether he was having problems with the current Mrs. P is anybody's guess.
He paused.
Have you met Crystal yet?
I shook my head. Odessa lifted his brows and shook his hand as though he'd burned it.
She's a beautiful woman. Hard to picture anyone walking out on her.
You have a theory?
Not me. From our perspective, so far, this is not a criminal matter. You got no crime, then there's no Miranda and no need for search warrants, which makes our job a hell of a lot easier. We're just a bunch of good guys trying to do the family a favor. Personally, I think things look bad, but I ain't gonna say that to anyone else, including you, he said.
I indicated the file. Mind if I take a look?
Wish I could, but this is Paglia's case. And he's hell on confidentiality. He doesn't mind us passing on the gist of it when it seems appropriate. The point is to find the guy, which means we cooperate when we can.
He won't care if I go back and talk to some of these people?
You're free to do anything you want.
When he walked me out to the front, he said,
if you find him, let us know. He can stay gone if he wants, but I'd hate to keep putting in the hours if he's off in Las Vegas with a snoot full of coke.
You don't believe that.
No, I don't. Nor do you.
On the way back to the office, I did a 2-block detour and made a stop at the bank. I filled out a deposit slip, endorsed Fiona's check, and waited my turn in line. When I reached the window, I pointed to the account number printed on the face. Could you verify the balance in this account? I want to be sure the check's good before I make the deposit. Another lesson learned the hard way. I don't start work until the check is cleared. The teller, Barbara, was one I'd been dealing with for years. I watched while she typed in the account number on her computer keyboard and then studied the screen. She hit the enter key once, tap, again, tap. I watched as her eyes traced the lines of print. She looked back at my deposit slip and made a face. This is covered, but it's close. Want the cash instead? The deposit's fine, but let's do it before another check comes in and leaves her short. Chapter 3. I returned to the office to find that Jill and Ida Ruth had left a note on my door. Kinsey, below is an itemized record of Jennifer's tardy days, screw-ups, and unexplained absences. Please add any other incidents you know of, sign this, and leave it on my desk. We think it's best if we present a unified front. We mean business. Ida Ruth. I dropped the list in my trash and put a call through to Crystal Purcell at the house in Horton Ravine. The housekeeper informed me she'd left for the beach house, where she'd be spending the weekend. She gave me the number, which I dialed as soon as we'd hung up. I hoped the woman who answered would be Crystal, but when I asked for her by name, I was put on hold until a second woman picked up.
"This is Crystal," she said.
I identified myself by name and occupation, hoping she wouldn't be annoyed by the idea of yet another detective. According to the newspapers, she'd already talked to investigators from the Santa Teresa Police Department. I told her I'd met with Fiona that morning and that she asked me to look into Dr. Purcell's disappearance. I know you've gone over the subject repeatedly, but I'd appreciate hearing the story from you, if you can bear telling it again. There was a momentary pause wherein I could have sworn she was practicing her Zen deep breathing.
"This is very hard."
"I'm aware of that, and I'm sorry."
"How soon?"
"That's entirely up to you. The sooner the better." There was another pause.
"How much are you charging?"
"Fiona? $50 an hour, which is on the low end of the scale. A big city private eye is paid twice that." Briefly, I wondered why I sounded so apologetic. Maybe she'd prefer to chat with someone whose services were worth more.
"Stop by at 5. I'm on Paloma Lane."
She gave me the number.
"Do you know where that is?"
"I can find it. I'll try not to take too much of your time."
"Take all you want. Fiona's the one paying."
I left the office at 4 o'clock, stopping by my apartment on my way to Crystal's beach house. The accumulating cloud cover had generated an artificial twilight, and the smell of gathering rain had infused the air. I'd left windows open in the loft, and I wanted to get the place buttoned down properly against the coming storm. I parked the car out in front and pushed through the gate with its reassuring whine and squeak. I followed the narrow concrete walk around the side of the building to the backyard. My apartment was formerly a single-car garage converted into living quarters. My studio consists of a small living room with a sofa bed for guests tucked into a bay window, a built-in desk, a kitchenette, a stacking washer-dryer combination, and a bathroom downstairs. Above, accessible by a tiny spiral staircase, I have a sleeping loft with a platform bed and a second bathroom. The interior resembles a sturdy little seagoing vessel, complete with a porthole in the front door, teak-paneled walls and sufficient nooks and crannies, cubbyholes and niches to accommodate my small store of possessions. The best part of all is the good soul who makes this possible. My landlord, Henry Pitts. He's 86 years old, handsome, thrifty, energetic, and competent. He worked as a commercial baker for most of his professional life, and even in retirement, can't quite give up his addiction to breads, pies, and cakes. He not only produces a steady stream of baked goods, but he caters luncheons and high teas for all the old ladies in the neighborhood. In addition, he trades his fresh breads and dinner rolls for meals at the corner tavern, where he eats 3 to 4 nights a week. At the head of the driveway, I could see Henry's garage door standing open, though both vehicles were in place. As I turned left onto the patio, I spotted him on a ladder outside his bedroom,
putting up the last of his storm windows. He wore shorts and a tank top, his long legs looking knotty, his tan all but faded now that winter was here. The Santa Teresa temperatures never drop much below 50, but he's originally from Michigan, and despite the fact he's been in Southern California more than 40 years, his lingering attachment to the seasons dictates the installation of window screens in late spring and storm windows in late fall. The weather itself is immaterial to him. The patio was still littered with cleaning supplies, the garden hose, wads of crumpled newspaper, a wire brush, a bucket of water mixed with vinegar, and numerous sponges gray with soot. Henry waved from his perch and then eased carefully down the ladder, whistling tunelessly to himself. I paused to help him clean up, tossing dingy water in the bushes, while he rewound the hose into a terracotta pot.
"You're home early," he remarked.
"I thought I'd better close my windows before the rain, assuming we'll actually have some," I said. Henry'd often complained that the rain in California lacked the bluster and theatrics of a good Midwestern storm. Many times the promised rain failed to materialize at all, or arrived in a form barely sufficient to wet the pavement. We're seldom treated to the displays of thunder and lightning he remembers with such enthusiasm from his Michigan youth. Henry said,
"Why didn't you call? I could have saved you a trip. Stick the brush in that bucket. I'll take it in with me when I go."
This was right on my way. I have an appointment at 5 o'clock down on Paloma Lane, so I was heading in this direction. Any excuse to avoid the office. Too much nonsense for my taste.
"How's the search for new space?"
I waggled my hand back and forth, indicating not so good. Something will come up. Meanwhile, I have a new client. At least I'm 99% sure.
"Why the hesitation?"
Might be the aggravation at the office spilling over into this. I am interested in the case, but I'm not convinced I can be effective. This is the doctor who's been missing.
I remember reading about that. Still no sign of him?
Nope. His ex-wife thinks the cops aren't showing the proper initiative. Frankly, she strikes me as the type who likes to make people jump through hoops.
You'll do fine.
With that, he returned to the ladder, which he collapsed and carried back across the patio to the garage. I watched him ease around his 1932 Chevy coupe and hang the ladder on the wall. His garage is lined with pegboard, with the location for each item neatly silhouetted in paint.
"You have time for some tea?" he asked, coming back across the yard.
I glanced at my watch. Better not. I'll see you later up at Rosie's.
I'll be there closer to 7 than to 6. She's actually on her way over, so I better get washed up. She's asked me for help, but she won't say with what.
I said, "Uh-oh." He waved dismissively.
"It's probably something simple. I don't mind a bit. If she shows while I'm gone, tell her I'll be back in a flash, as soon as I've cleaned up."
Henry crossed to his back door and went into the kitchen, where I could see him through the window, scrubbing up at the sink. He smiled when he caught my eye and started whistling to himself again. I turned when I heard the gate squeak. Rosie appeared moments later, toting a brown paper bag. She owns the Hungarian tavern where Henry's older brother, William, now functions as the manager. William and Rosie were married Thanksgiving Day the year before, and they live in an apartment above her restaurant, which is half a block away. William is 87 years old, and where Rosie once swore she was in her 60s, she now admits to being in her 70s, though she won't specify where. She's short and top-heavy, with a coquettish cap of red hair dyed the color of Florida oranges. As usual, she was wearing a muumuu, this one a gaudy jungle of orange and gold, the skirt lifting sail-like against the rising wind. She brightened when she saw me.
"Kinsey is good. Here's for Henry," she said, opening the bag for me.
I peered at the contents, half expecting to see kittens.
"What is that? Is that trash?"
Rosie shifted her weight from one foot to the other, refusing to make eye contact, a strategy she employs when she's guilty, ill at ease, or maneuvering like crazy.
"Is my sister Clotilde's medical bills for hospital and after she died? Henry's going to explain. I can't make into heads or tails with this."
Rosie's perfectly capable of speaking grammatically. She only butchers vocabulary and syntax when she's trying to seem helpless, thus conning you into doing her some outrageous favor.
This is especially true when she's dealing with her state and federal taxes, which Henry's done without a murmur for the past 6 years. Now, slyly, she said, "You gonna help, I hope. He shouldn't do by himself. It's not fair." "Why can't William pitch in?"
"Clotilde preferred Henry."
"But she's deceased," I said.
"Before she deceased herself, she preferred," she said,
smiling coyly, as though that cinched it. I dropped the argument. It was really up to Henry, though it irritated me intensely that she'd take advantage of him. The Clotilde in question was Rosie's cranky older sister. I'd never been able to pronounce her Hungarian surname, which abounded in consonants and strange punctuation marks. She'd suffered for years from an unspecified degenerative disease. She used a wheelchair since she was in her 50s, plagued by a variety of other ailments that necessitated copious medications and numerous hospital stays. Finally, in her 70s, she'd been advised to undergo hip replacement surgery. This was in April, some 7 months back. Though the surgery had been successful, Clotilde had been outraged by the rigors of convalescence. She'd resisted all attempts to get her on her feet, balked at nourishment, refused to use a bedpan, pulled out catheters and feeding tubes, flung her pills at the nurses, and sabotaged her physical therapy. After the customary 5 days in the hospital, she was moved to a nursing home where, over the course of the next several weeks, she began to decline. She'd finally succumbed to pneumonia, dysphagia, malnutrition, and kidney failure. Rosie had not been exactly stricken when she passed.
"She should have passed a long time ago," said she. "She's a pain in the patootie. That's what happens when you don't behave. She should have done what doctors say. She should never resist help when he know best. Now I got this and I don't know what to do with. Here, you take."
Judging from the weight and heft of the bag, she'd gotten into some resistance of her own, letting all the paperwork pile up. It'd take Henry weeks to get everything sorted out. He emerged from the back door and crossed the patio to us. He changed out of his tank top and shorts into a flannel shirt and long pants. "I got a scoot," I said, and set the bag on the ground. Henry peered in. "Is this trash?" By the time I let myself into my apartment, he was already hauling the bag toward his kitchen door, nodding sympathetically while Rosie lurched through a tortured explanation of her plight. I dropped my shoulder bag on a kitchen stool while I circled the apartment, closing windows and locking them. I turned on lamps as I went so the place would look cheerful when I got home. Upstairs, I pulled on a clean white turtleneck, which I wore with my jeans. I shrugged back into my gray tweed blazer, traded my sockinis for black boots, and studied myself in the bathroom mirror. The effect was just what you'd expect. A tweed blazer with jeans. Works for me, I thought. Paloma Lane is a shady two-lane road that runs between Highway 101 and the Pacific Ocean, sharing the irregular strip of land with the Southern Pacific Railroad. Despite the proximity to the freight and passenger trains thundering past twice daily, many houses along Paloma sell in the millions depending on the number of linear feet of beachfront a property claims. The houses vary in style from pseudo-Cape Cod to mock Tudor to faux Mediterranean to contemporary. All are situated as far away from the railroad tracks as possible and as close to the sand as county setbacks permit. Crystal Purcell's lot was one of the few without electronic gates. The house next door, to the left of hers, bore a discreet for sale sign with a price-reduced banner across the center. Crystal's house filled the narrow lot. The glass and cedar structure was probably 40 feet wide and 3 stories high, each floor angled strategically to keep the neighboring houses out of sight. To the left, an open carport sheltered a silver Audi convertible and a new white Volvo, with a vanity license plate that read Crystal. The end slot was free, probably where Dal Purcell had parked his Mercedes. To the right, there was room for an additional 3 cars on the gravel stretch where I parked my slightly dinged 1974 VW. The rear facade of the house was austere, a windowless wall of weathering wood. On either side of the door, a row of 30-foot fan palms had been